Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Good afternoon, everyone. Everybody should have a copy of the handout of Suchi Loma Sutta. This is continuing with the Sutta Nipata. In the book, it's pages 30 and 31, but I'm using a different translation, my own translation. Okay, this sutta takes the form, or it occurs in the context of a story. And the story takes the form of a dialogue between the Buddha and a yaka named Suchi Loma. My own supposition or hypothesis is that originally the verses that form the heart of these suttas were separate compositions. And at some point in the evolution of the early Buddhist canon, in order to give some life to the verses and to make them somewhat more meaningful as themes for exposition and elaboration, they came to be incorporated, at least some of them were taken and incorporated into the form of a story. They were embedded within the framework of a story. And these stories, often they have the purpose of showing how the Buddha enters into dialogue with beings of the supernatural order of his period, the yakas or the demons, the sometimes with different types of devas, deities, in order to show the role of the Buddha, as sort of to highlight the role of the Buddha as a world teacher. And so in this particular sutta, the story begins when the Buddha is living near the town of Gaya, and he's living at the haunt, the dwelling place of this yaka named Suchi Loma. Now the word, or the name Suchi Loma, means one who has body hairs that are sharp as needles. Suchi is needle, and loma is body hair. So the yakas are often depicted as terrifying demonic beings. But they are beings who have potentially wholesome states of consciousness. They have the potential for awakening wisdom and for gaining the realization of world-transcending states of enlightenment. And so in this occasion, the yaka Suchi Loma and another yaka named Kara are passing by near the Buddha. And then the yaka named Kara points out the Buddha to Suchi Loma and describes him as a samana, an ascetic. And he says, that is an ascetic. But Suchi Loma says, that is not a real ascetic. He is a sham ascetic. Because in that time there were many imposters who would wear the robes of a renunciant in order to go around from town to town to receive respect and veneration from people and to live an easy life, getting offerings, food, dwelling places. So then Suchi Loma says, I'll find out whether he is a real ascetic or an imposter. And I think the mark of a real ascetic is that a real ascetic would not show any fear when approached by a yucca. And so then the yucca Suchi Loma comes to the Buddha and bends over him. And the Buddha bends back, draws back. The yucca Suchi Loma then says to him, are you afraid of me? And the Buddha says, I'm not afraid of you, friend. It is just that your touch is evil. It doesn't really mean evil in a moral sense, but because Suchi Loma has these needle hairs that are like needles, he means that your touch is painful. Then Suchi Loma presents a challenge to the Buddha. He says, I'll ask you a question, ascetic. If you won't answer me, then I will drive you insane, or I'll split your heart, or I'll grab you by the feet and throw you across the river Ganges. And so if an ascetic were to present a challenge like that to any normal ascetic, that ascetic would be terrified and frightened. But the Buddha says, I do not see anyone in this world, friend, including all of its devas, Mara and Brahma, in this generation or population, with its ascetics and Brahmins, its devas and humans, who could drive me insane or split my heart or grab me by the feet and hurl me across the Ganges. Because for anybody to do that, they would have to be have greater spiritual power than the Buddha. But the Buddha in this whole world is the one with the greatest spiritual power, the greatest spiritual accomplishment. So who can do that to the Buddha? But the Buddha now gives him this invitation to ask any question that he wants. Because the Buddha knows that Suchi Loma has this potential for awakening to the truth. And so now Suchi Loma the Buddha wants to draw a question out from Suchi Loma. So he invites Suchi Loma to ask any question that might be on his mind. And from the question, we could see that Suchi Loma was not just a shallow being, but he had deeply pondered upon some philosophical, psychological problems. And these problems might have obsessed his thinking for a long time. And now that the Buddha has come to his presence, he wants to have these questions resolved. And so he asks the question, which I'll recite in Pali first and then translate. Rāgo chado so chakuto nidana arati rati loma hangso kuto ja kuto samutaya mano vitakka kumaraka vankam evos Kumaraka dankamivo sajanti. There are actually two ways to take the last line. Okay. First I'll read the way that I've translated here. What is the source of lust and hatred? From whence spring discontent, delight, and terror? Having arisen from what? What do they arise from? The mind's thoughts. Okay, having arisen from what do the mind's thoughts toss one around? As boys toss up a crow. Now the commentary explains this last line to mean that, you see, in ancient India, boys were just as mischievous as boys are today. And so what boys in that time would do, they would catch a crow, and then somehow they would tie the foot of the crow to a little post that they would plant in the ground. Then they would release the crow, and then the crow would fly up into the sky thinking that it's free. But because the crow is tied to a post in the ground, as the crow starts to fly away, the string unwinds and it eventually comes to the end of the string. And then the crow gets pulled back down to the ground and it falls to the ground. Then the crow doesn't know what's wrong. And so it tries to fly up again into the sky and it again falls down. Then the boys, mischievously, they start throwing stones at the crow. And again it tries to fly away, and it again falls down. So in this way the crow keeps on flying up, falling down, flying up, falling down. Until the boys, if they're kind, they finally release it. Another way to take the last line, just by changing one letter, two letters, it could then have the meaning, then the last two lines would have the meaning, having arisen from what do the mind's thoughts fall away, just as children, little as young boys, descend from the hip, that is, of the hip of their nurse or their mother. Like in India, the mothers would carry their children in little baskets on their hips. And then when they want to let the children down onto the ground, they open this little basket and the little child descends down onto the ground. And so this is taken as an image for the way thoughts slide out from the mind. Rise up from the mind and slip away, slip away. But let us take the first interpretation of the line. So here we have Suchi Loma inquiring. He sees that in the mind, that the mind is constantly plagued by these problems, emotional problems, of raga and dosa, lust and hatred. And he's wondering, where do these defilements arise from? how is it that they come into the mind? Then we have these other disturbing mental states. One is discontent. This can be dissatisfaction, boredom, restlessness, the mind that's constantly finding faults with one's present situation. And this leads to, or its opposite is delight, which is understood not to mean the wholesome delight in virtuous activities, virtuous states, but rather this is sensual delight. Delight in the pleasures of the senses. And if we consider the way the mind works, we can see that it is constantly oscillating between discontent and delight. Often we find ourselves bored, discontented, dissatisfied with our present situation. And so, instead of trying to tackle that discontent at its root, we try to escape from that discontent by running into the enjoyment of sense pleasures. And then the sense pleasures becomes a way of drowning out that discontent, but they provide only a temporary relief from the discontent. Because once one manages to acquire and to enjoy certain types of sense pleasures, eventually a familiarization will set in with these sense pleasures. And once one becomes familiar with them, accustomed to them, again new discontent will set in. And then one has to pursue new sense pleasures, more sense pleasures. So in order for sense pleasures to continue to give satisfaction, there has to be continued variety and novelty. We could say that novelty is the key to satisfaction in sense pleasures. But the defect in novelty, and this is inherent in the very word novelty, which means newness, is that novelty never remains new. Novelty wears off. What is novel now becomes familiar, becomes habitual. And when what is novel becomes familiar and habitual, then the reaction to that habituation is discontent. And so we have a perpetually repeating cycle of novelty, discontent, let us say beginning with discontent. We become discontent with what we have. We have to pursue something new and different. We obtain what is new and different. Then we are delighted with it, proud of it, and we enjoy it for some time. Then after we enjoy it for some time, it starts to become boring, tedious. And then we look out and find something else that's new, different, exciting. And that arouses a new craving to acquire it. Change of scene. And then we pursue the new object of enjoyment until we obtain it. And then we can enjoy that. We could see this in the world of fashion. That's why we have different fashions. Fashion designers always have to change the fashions. So one season, say for women, I remember long time ago, women used to wear very long skirts. That was the fashion. Then they changed the style to the short skirts. And so no woman would want to wear the long skirt. Any woman found wearing the long skirt becomes ashamed of herself. She cannot go out amongst other women, too embarrassed to do so. And if one is has a closet full of long skirts, one looks into the closet, what shall I wear when I go out to a party, to a concert, to the office? And one is ashamed to go out in the long skirts because everybody else is going out in the short skirts. And so all of one's whole wardrobe becomes an object of discontent. And now one opens the newspapers, the fashion pages, the new style of the short skirts, bright colors, very, very enticing. So this becomes what inflames one's desire. One has to possess the short skirts. And so now one goes out to the clothing shops, buys the short skirts, gets rid of all of one's old skirts, sends them to the second-hand shop, or even maybe just entirely discards them. Now one has the closet full of short skirts. For a few seasons, this is the fashion. But the clothes designers, the clothes manufacturers, they know how to keep their market working. So after a couple of years, change the style. Again, bring in the long skirts as the fashion. And so then you have the models going on the catwalks wearing the long skirts. And now the woman wearing the short skirts, ashamed, how could I be dressing like this? All the fashionable women are wearing the long skirts. And so now one has to go buy the long skirts. And so this is the way discontent. Then when one buys the long skirts again, now one is delighted. Now one can go out, concerts, parties, very proud of oneself, showing I have the latest fashions. Same thing with cars. One year it's the big car, one particular type of color, bright, shiny colors. Then the bright, shiny colors go out of fashion. It's the kind of muted, delicately hued colors. Then the muted, delicately hued colors go out of fashion. The bright, shiny colors come into fashion again. And so one has to keep on changing one's cars because the colors that one has previously, that one was previously delighted with, go out of fashion and one becomes discontent with them. And we shouldn't think, that monk is making fun of us lay people. They think that they are so superior. Sitting up there, they think that they're so superior. I remember in Sri Lanka a few years ago, you see in Sri Lanka, all the monks used to use I think it was made of cast iron alms bowls. What was the metal? I think it was a cast iron. And every monk who had the cast iron alms bowl, quite content with the cast iron alms bowl. Then in Thailand, they started making these stainless steel alms bowls, bright, shiny, metal, very light, nicely shaped, and a few monks from Sri Lanka who had gone to Thailand would come back bringing their stainless steel alms bowls. Like one would come to the monastery with a stainless steel alms bowl. The other monks would look at him. Then they would look back at their cast iron alms bowls and think, what? How can we use these cast iron alms bowls? Now there are stainless steel alms bowls. Why don't we have stainless steel alms bowls? We have to ask our supporters to write to Thailand and get stainless steel alms bowls for us too. And so now, before long, there's huge shipments of stainless steel alms bowls coming from Thailand to Sri Lanka. And so Suchi Loma is asking, what is the source of this discontent, delight, and terror, fear? Maybe because he is a yucca, this frightening being. Whenever he would approach or go over the village and people would see him, he would see how all the people are terrified and frightened of him. And he's wondering, am I the real cause of fear and terror, or is there some other internal cause for fear and terror? And so he's asking, what is that real cause, the inner cause of terror? Having arisen from what do the mind's thoughts? Then here I put in an interpretive translation. Toss one around as boys toss up a crow. This shows the way the thoughts affect us in our day-to-day life. We might think that we are the masters of our own mind. We're in control of our own minds. But actually, when our minds are being constantly bombarded by these moods and emotions of lust or greed, anger or hatred, discontent, dissatisfaction, then seeking delight or enjoyment in the pleasures of the senses, constantly troubled by terror, by worry, by fear, and with regard to this terror, should mention as a sideline how the politicians know how to use this terror in order to control populations, to manipulate them, in order to make people afraid and then to line up behind themselves and support them because one wants security. And so if one is afraid, then one will naturally turn to that political leader who is able to say, I will protect you from terror. So the one who can present the toughest image, who can present the appearance of being able to give the greatest security, even if the rest of his policies are defective, unjust, that politician will be the one who will attract people to him. And people will flock to that leader, not because they can recognize the true qualities of a leader, not because they recognize somebody who will lead with righteousness and with justice, but because they're afraid. And to escape from fear, they cower beneath the one who seems capable of giving protection, who seems capable of granting them security, securing their narrow interests. Okay, so now Suchi Loma has asked his questions, and the Buddha answers. Answering, he says, the first part of the answer in the Pali, it's a little bit cryptic. The Buddha says, Rāgo ca dosa ca ito nidāna arati rati loma hangso ito ja ito samudaya mano vitakka kumaraka dankamivo sajanti. Lust and hatred have their source in this. From this spring discontent, delight, and terror. Having arisen from this, the mind's thoughts toss one around as boys toss up a crow. The way I see it, verse 809 is not yet directly answering the question, but it's just leading on to the answer, which will be given in verse 810. I'm sorry, this is in the Sangyutta Nikaya version, in the Sutta Nipata version, in the translation by Sadatisa. He says, passion and hatred spring from egotism, so do discontent, attachment, and terror. But when he puts an egotism as the answer, he's taking the answer from the commentary, and then he's interpreting it in a particular way. Whereas I prefer to translate directly from the sutta, and not put in an interpretation from the commentary. Okay, then when we go to verse 810, then the meter changes. Sneha jāta sambhuta nigroda seva kanda jā putu visata kamesu malu vava vitatavane. Sprung from affection, arisen from oneself, like the trunk-borne shoots of the banyan tree, manifold, clinging to sensual pleasures, like a maluva creeper stretched across the woods. Here the answer is that they have sprung from, the word given is sneha, which literally it means moisture, but it takes on the meaning of the moisture of craving. And this craving is said to be something atta-sambhuta, something that is sprung up from within oneself. So in other words, these things, all of these defiling mental states, these disturbing mental states, can ultimately be traced to craving. And craving is something which arises from within oneself. So here the Buddha is turning this inquiry of the yaksha, Suchi Loma, he's turning the inquiry around on its head, and it's saying that all of these disturbing all of these disturbing, afflicting mental qualities. If one wants to find the source from which they spring, one has to look around and look within oneself, for it is within oneself that they arise. And what is that particular quality or factor or force within oneself that brings one into being? It is craving that brings them into being. Craving is that powerful force that rises up from the depths of the mind and then branches out as lust. That is the first expression of craving, the direct manifestation. Lust or raga, maybe lust is too narrow a translation, since lust only usually suggests sexual desire. But raga is any kind of strong self-centered desire, the desire to acquire, or any kind of strong attachment. And hatred is the reaction or response when desire, craving is frustrated. It's the response of aversion, enmity, antagonism towards that which is preventing the satisfaction of desire. Craving is what brings delight, rati, since when one can satisfy one's craving, then one enjoys oneself. So when people have the desire to indulge the senses and they can satisfy the senses, one can see beautiful forms. One listens to beautiful music. One can eat delicious food of various kinds. That is giving delight, because it's giving delight because one is satisfying the craving. But then when that indulgence of the sense pleasure becomes habitual and familiar, then that boredom sets in, discontent sets in, or when one sees other types of pleasure that one doesn't have, when one sees the possibility of different types of enjoyment, then one becomes discontent with what one has. And then when one perceives threats to one's possessions, threats to one's security, then there arises terror. And that terror is coming from this, we call it this basic craving for security. Even a craving to preserve the status quo, because the status quo is often it's a secure, familiar situation. And so when people are forced to move from one country to another country, or forced to change their way of life due to circumstances, situations, then they become anxious and fearful because they have to deal with the unfamiliar. And that fear, and anxiety originates from a craving for what is familiar, comfortable, what gives us the sense of security. And so all of these disturbing, afflictive states arise from within oneself And the Buddha compares this to the shoots of the banyan tree. The banyan tree, it's a type of tree that grows in South Asia, Southeast Asia. It sends down its branches and the branches come out from the trunk and the branches will send down shoots which go down into the ground. And those shoots that come out from the branches will become trunks as well. And they will send out their branches, which will extend still further, which will also send down shoots, which will become trunks. And so one can have the banyan tree spreading far and wide over a long area, over a very wide area. In the famous poem, Paradise Lost, by John Milton, John Milton has described the banyan tree in his description of the Garden of Eden. I'll read this verse from Paradise Lost. He says, you see, the banyan tree, it's a type of fig tree. So Milton says, the fig tree spreads her arms, branching so broad and long that in the ground the bended twigs take root and daughters grow about the mother tree, a pillared shade high overarched and echoing walks between. Okay, so in this way, this illustrates the way craving can grow and send down shoots. The craving becomes attached to one object after another. And the Buddha also illustrates the way craving becomes attached to different sensual pleasures, to the way a particular type of creeper spreads throughout the woods. There's this creeper called the Maluva creeper, which spreads out throughout the woods, and sometimes this creeper will attach itself to a tree, and it will grow up around the tree, and then it grows up over the tree, over the branches, and then it will pull the branches of the tree apart and actually split the tree so that the tree will split and fall down. In this way, the Maluva creeper can sometimes destroy the tree on which it's based. But here the idea is that the Maluva creeper goes spreading throughout the whole woods. And in the same way, sensual craving goes spreading, attaching itself to one object after another. One never becomes satisfied with any amount of sense pleasures, but it's the nature of sensual desire always to spread from object to object. And whatever object it attaches to, it clings to and doesn't want to let go of. But now the Buddha continues. Ye nang pujananti yato nidanang te nang vino dainti suno hiyaka te du tarang ogami mang taranti Atina pubanga puna pava Atina pubanga puna pavaya. Those who understand their source, that is, the source from which all of these afflictive states arise, lust and hatred, discontent, delight, and terror. Who know where these disturbing thoughts originate from? That is, who understand that all of these afflictive thoughts arise from that craving arisen within oneself. They dispel it. Then the Buddha adds this emphatic, listen, O Yaka. They cross this flood, so hard to cross, uncrossed before, for no renewed existence. So those who understand that all of these afflictive, disturbing emotions and thoughts originate from that craving hidden deep within themselves, they dispel that craving, and then they cross this flood of samsara, this boundless ocean of birth and death, which they've never crossed before. And by crossing this ocean, they never again come back into Puna Bhava, into renewed existence, into that cycle of birth, aging, sickness, and death. So, in this verse, even in this verse, the Buddha is teaching the Four Noble Truths, like all of these afflictive mental states which are tossing the mind around, we could say are different aspects of the truth of dukkha, the truth of suffering. And when they spring from affection, they spring from craving that's arisen from oneself, that craving, that is the second noble truth, the truth of the origin of suffering. Then that state of no, that dispelling of the source, cutting off craving for no renewed existence, that is the third noble truth of the cessation of suffering. And then what's implied here in the act of dispelling craving is the fourth noble truth, that is the path to the cessation of suffering. And then the commentary tells us that when the Buddha finished speaking this verse, the Yaka Suchi Loma grasped the meaning of the verse, the meaning of the Buddha's answer, and he developed the, right on that spot there arose in him the pure eye of Dhamma, the vision of Dhamma, and he became a stream enterer. And as soon as he became a stream enterer, then his physical appearance changed from that of a horrible-looking yaksha into that of a quite pleasant-looking earth deity, earth-dwelling deity. Okay, this is the end of the discourse. I thank you all for your attention, and may the blessings of the Triple Gem be with you all. Okay, we do the sharing of the merits. Akasata ca bhumatha Devanaga mahidika Panyantang anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanam. Akasata Cha Bhumata Devanaga Mahidika Punyantam Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Desanam. Akasata Cha Bhumata Devanaga Mahidika Punyantam Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Mang Parang Etavata Chamhehi Sampadang Punyasampadang Sabe Deva Anumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Etavata Chamhehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Bhuta Anumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Etavata Chamhehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Sata Anumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Bhavagupadaya Avicihe Tato Etantare Satakai Upapanna Rupi arupicha asanya sannino Dukha pamuchantu pusantu niputin.